The second case for oral argument this morning is the Elvin Sound Sleeper Appellant versus the State of South Dakota Appellee. For the appellant is Mr. Paul Peets or Pites?
Peets.
So I had a 50-50 chance. And for the State of South Dakota is Ms. Kristen Jasper. Counsel, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Peets. I represent the appellant by the name of Elvin Sound Sleeper. The issues in this appeal deal with the application of Terry versus Ohio in regards to the seizure of the defendant. On January 29th, 2009, Detective Kelvin Moser was in a parking lot at an Exxon gas station in Rapid City, South Dakota. He was there investigating an unrelated theft at that location. He was in plain clothes, was driving an unmarked police vehicle. When he was leaving the gas station, he observed a male subject walk out of the gas station with a case of beer and a bottle in a brown paper bag. He observed this individual get into the passenger seat of a vehicle, at which time the individual, later identified as Tony Hutchinson, removed this bottle, appeared to show it to the other occupants of the vehicle, and then as he brought it back down to where the officer could no longer see it, there appeared to be a twisting motion, which raised the concern in the officer's mind that there was an open container in the vehicle. The detective did not approach the car at this time. He continued to observe the car as it left the parking lot, followed the vehicle, made the decision not to pull the vehicle over, but instead called dispatch to have a marked vehicle come over and pull the vehicle over. While he was observing this, calling dispatch, the vehicle pulled into another business, parked. The detective parked behind them, and then went up and contacted defendant Sound Sleeper. During that investigation, he realized that Mr. Sound Sleeper did not have a valid license and eventually arrested him for a DUI charge. The issues in this case, the first issue that we raised in our brief, I'm only going to touch on briefly. My primary reason for touching on it is there was some discussion on the standard of review, and in researching this case and looking at it further, I don't think there's any dispute of fact in this particular case. There was only one witness that testified at the time in front of the trial court. There was no other witnesses that contradicted anything that was testified to by the officer. Therefore, I don't think this is a clearly erroneous standard, as the state had indicated in its brief. There is a difference between looking at a person's credibility and also looking at the reasonableness of what occurred in this case as applied to the law as stated in Terry versus Ohio. And the important thing here is that Terry has always said that it's a totality of the circumstances that we look at. Most of the time, as an officer continues to observe, he sees things that will, you know, enhance or decrease that totality of the circumstances. Here, had the officer immediately walked up to the vehicle and approached the vehicle, I don't think there would be any question. But as he continued to observe them, he saw things that would decrease the reasonableness here. The first of all would be the fact that he never sees the bottle again. He never sees the person take a drink from it, never sees the person try to resecure the cap on it. These are common things that a standard person would do with a container, any kind of liquid container in a vehicle. Detective Mosher never sees any actions in regards to this. In fact, never sees the open container again until later in the stop, when he finally realizes that the container is sealed. Although the officer could not possibly know at the time of his approaching this vehicle that the container was sealed, I do think that goes somewhat to the reasonableness when you consider, you know, how reasonable is it that somebody saw something that didn't actually occur. And I think that still needs to be taken into account. The bigger issue here is the second issue.
Wait a minute, though. You're not suggesting that we analyze Fourth Amendment cases by what in fact turns out. I mean, it's an objective reasonableness standard that we use, and if that could cut both ways, that would suggest if they actually find drugs or something in a case, that would justify it. You're certainly not suggesting that we use that kind of backward-looking analysis, are you?
No, I'm certainly not. Obviously, an officer can see something that he perceives to be a crime that later turns out is not. I mean, that's obviously the case. Here we're looking at something where he's factually claims that he's seen something. And the question is based on the fact that, you know, that actually did not occur, does that go into the reasonableness of it? And that's more, I think it goes more to the issue of, you know, how reasonable is what he saw, especially in concern with these particular facts where you have the beverage being brought down below the level where he can see, and then the actual motion of the arms is what is indicating the twist he managed. How reasonable was that in concerns that it wasn't open at all?
Well, Terry expressly says that the officer is entitled to either confirm or dispel the suspicion.
That's correct.
So what difference does it make?
It's just my opinion that I think that it goes to the reasonableness of what the officer is claiming that he saw. Obviously, the bigger issue in this case is not my first issue in the that was listed in the appeal. It's obviously the second issue. If this court were to hold that there was reasonable suspicion to approach the car, there still was not reasonable suspicion to approach Sound Sleeper. And that is the primary and the bigger issue. Terry and its progeny of cases was very clear that suspicion is particularized to a particular individual. The officer must have a suspicion, a reasonable suspicion that's particularized to the individual that's being stopped. In this case, the officer, in his own testimony, testified that he had no belief that Sound Sleeper had committed any crimes when he approached Sound Sleeper. So in my mind, that's the end of the analysis in this case, because he has to have a reasonable suspicion that Sound Sleeper has committed a crime before he can subject him to a Terry stop. This is a very specific and very narrow exception to the Fourth Amendment requirement.
That would certainly be true if you're stopping someone on the street, a pedestrian. But do you have a case that says that the police officer has to go to the person in the car who's manifested some suspicion, as opposed to going first to the driver to make sure the car is, not going anywhere?
Well, first of all, the car's not going anywhere. The officer's parked behind him. There's no way for them to be able to back out to leave. Do I have a case that specifically says he has to approach the driver instead of the passenger? I don't know if that it's actually pretty rare that the probable cause arises out of the passenger in any kind of automobile case. There were a couple of cases out of New Mexico, a case out of Pennsylvania, dealing with passengers, but most of the time they usually go to another passenger. There was only one case out of New Mexico, I believe it was called Ferdenberg, that they had suspicion of a forger. They discovered that the passenger, after stopping the vehicle, after getting identification from both of the people, had discovered that the passenger was the forger. At that point, court had said that they're done with the driver. Later in the stop, statements by the passenger then led them back to the driver, and there was an arrest of the driver as well. I think the better question in that situation is there a case that says that they can approach a driver when the driver there's no reasonable suspicion towards the driver? And I think all of the lines of cases have said that. They're very specific in that the reasonable suspicion has to be to the person that's being stopped. The thing that makes this case confusing is that we have a long line of cases, Vento, Kenyon, Little Brave, a number of cases where this court has said anytime that there's a traffic stop, the officer has the right to go up and ask for a driver's license and insurance and so forth. The difference in those cases, and all of those cases, which the state relies very heavily on in their brief, is predicated on the fact that the driver is the one that they're stopping the car for in the first place. There's a violation by the driver. Vento is another case. In Vento, it was an improperly displayed license plate. That is a violation attributable to the driver. In Kenyon, I believe it was, yeah, just a moment here. In Kenyon, it was a broken taillight. I mean, in each and every one of those cases, Ballard was another one. Muller was another one. In Muller, it was an obstructed license plate. All of those stops have always been attributable to the driver. And here we don't even have a vehicle stop. The officer did not pull the vehicle over. He didn't make any, he didn't turn on any lights, make any hand signals in any way to pull the vehicle over. He got to the point where the vehicle stopped voluntarily on its own. The question is it a traffic stop based on the fact that the officer's actual actions in pulling the vehicle over, or is it based on the officer making a seizure of someone that's considered to be that has committed a traffic violation? This case doesn't have either one. The officer doesn't pull the vehicle over, doesn't make any effort to cause the vehicle to stop through police action. And when he's going up to the vehicle, he doesn't have a traffic violation that he's dealing with. He hasn't seen Sound Sleeper. In fact, he admitted that the driver made no traffic violations as he's following him. So what we have here is no probable cause towards Sound Sleeper or any of the other occupants of the vehicle other than the passenger.
Is the open container law only go to the person who is in custody of the open, or does it go to the driver as well?
That was an interesting case. In the New Mexico cases that I referred to, State versus Patterson dealt with an open container specifically. And that was at 139 New Mexico 332. I do have copies of that case to provide to the court at the end of this hearing. The court in that case looked at it was a backseat passenger that was possessing the open container, and then they moved to the front seat passenger. The court said there's no reasonable suspicion that person has ever possessed that container, which is a requirement under New Mexico law, and it's also a requirement under South Dakota law. South Dakota law, the open container law, requires that there's an open container in the vehicle and that's in the possession of a person. In this case, there's no reasonable suspicion that Sound Sleeper ever possessed this bottle. In fact, the officer was very specific. I did not see Sound Sleeper at any time possess this bottle. The stated argument in its brief, well, it's easy for this to have been passed around once it was in the vehicle. However, what might have or could have happened doesn't fit into reasonable suspicion. If that's the case, we have officers pulling over cars all the time for what might have been happening in the car that they've even observed.
The officer testified that he didn't see him pass it around or anyone take a drink. Didn't he testify to that?
Correct. That is absolutely correct.
So the only suspicion he has, if you get it into the suspicion, is he sees the brown paper bag. He sees a bottle. They take a bottle out of it. It's his impression that it's a bottle of beer.
Correct.
And then it's placed out of his sight, and he thinks that there is some motion that looks like it's taking the cap off. That's it, right?
That's correct. I mean, there's some contention on when exactly the twisty motion occurs, how much of the bottle is in view, and so forth. But that's essentially what he sees, yes. He never sees the bottle transferred to any other person. He never sees the bottle again until later when he approaches the vehicle and shortly after into the stop when he mentions, I'm here for an open container. They show him that it's sealed.
Is there any allegation in the record that either Huntington or any of the other members were juveniles to where mere possession is a crime?
No. Tony Hutchinson is well past the age of majority for drinking.
Okay.
Well.
Because that would put a different flavor on it. If this is a carload of juveniles, it'd be like drugs. Mere possession of it in the car is a crime.
Sure. And the two other individuals were never, or there was some dispute whether it was three or four. The officer couldn't remember whether there was three or four people in the car total. But there was never any indication or identification of the passenger or passengers in the back seat at all.
As long as we're clarifying facts, I just want to make sure I understand that you do not disagree, or you agree, at least according to your own findings, that the officer did believe it was a bottle of beer. There's no dispute about that.
He did believe that it was a bottle of beer, yes. His testimony was that he was close enough in proximity to the car when he viewed it that he could easily tell that it was a bottle of beer.
And the officer actually did some kind of demonstration in the courtroom that Judge Trimble looked at and made an assessment and made a finding then that he did reasonably believe it was being that he had opened a bottle of beer in the car.
The court's statement during at the end of the suppression hearing was essentially that the bottle was twisted while he was being held up, which was not exactly what the officer testified to. But there was a demonstration where the officer showed what he had remembered seeing of the bottle being open. That's correct.
Well, let me take it to your other point now about approaching the vehicle. Do you agree that if in the more usual situation where you have a more typical traffic stop like Vento and Kenyon and the other cases, that the officer can ask for the identification from the other passengers in the car?
Yes. Well, from the other passengers in the car?
Correct. On a traffic stop, when the officer approaches a vehicle, doesn't know what the officer may have, it's generally accepted that they can ask for identification from the people in the car.
I'm not sure if I would agree with that point. I think that has been generally accepted. I'm not sure, after doing the research in this case, that I am going to be letting that go in my practice any longer. I think that there might be an issue there in reading these cases. This court has previously said in some of the oral arguments that I've listened to that they avoid bright line rules, or there can't be a bright line rule in the reasonable suspicion area of the law because it's a case-by-case basis. But Terry does set out some very specific bright line rules in their exception. One of those being that it has to be the individual that's suspected of the crime. Another one is that it has to be reasonably related to the scope and that it has to be the least intrusive means possible. All of those things here, I think, were violated by the officer in his approach of sound sleeper. He admits on the stand that sound sleeper's identification, sound sleeper's ability or license to drive the car has nothing to do with his open container violation. The officer himself states that. That didn't have anything to do with that. That was a separate investigation, a separate inquiry. So the officer knew that he was contacting somebody that he had not seen commit any type of a crime. The least intrusive method in this case was obviously to contact the person that was suspected of the crime that he was investigating.
Mr. Peets, you said that when the officer saw the bottle of beer, that he thought it was beer. Isn't this an objective standard rather than a subjective standard on what would be reasonable from those actions? We need to rely on what the officer thought, or is it what a reasonable person would think?
When you're asking that question, are you talking about whether or not it's beer that's in the bottle?
What it was. Was it a bottle of beer? Yes.
It's an objective standard. I think Benzo is pretty clear on that.
All right. And the next question that wasn't briefed, no one said, was there any allegation or any finding as to profiling in this case? And I'm saying that because of the objective and subjective standard.
There wasn't.
And I'm saying that just from the surname. I have no idea. There's nothing in the brief about race.
You can keep the water up there if you like.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I get very dry, and if my lips start sticking together, you're not going to get any answers. I guess I'm a little bit... This is not an area that I wanted to go into, but since the court asked this question, I'm going to go into there. I have some serious concerns on why the stop occurred the way that it did. These were three or four Native Americans. The officer saw alcohol in the vehicle, and he immediately goes to the driver. I think his subjective intent was to see if the driver was intoxicated. I don't think I'm stepping out of bounds there, but that is not, under my understanding of the case law, that's not a concern of the court. We don't look at the subjective reasonings for the stop. We look at the objective reasonings. I think there's been numerous cases that have said, since Wren has basically said that if the officer has an objective reason for the stop, that the pretextual argument is not valid.
Just let me get to the line where you say it stopped being objectively reasonable. You're not challenging that the officer saw a bottle of beer. You're not challenging that.
I'm not.
Okay. So the question is what he saw, what the officer saw after he saw him put the beer back into the bag and put it below the line of sight. You're challenging whether that's objectively reasonable, what the officer says he saw at that point.
That's what I'm challenging in the first issue.
Right, I understand.
And of the two, I would admit that that's probably the weaker of the two issues. I think the more important issue is whether or not Sound Sleeper could be approached at all. Because even if there was reasonable suspicion that there was an open container, it was only ever seen in the possession of the passenger. The passenger is the only one that there's any reasonable suspicion to be approached in the first place. And this court has actually said, and I believe that was in Aberg, quoting Cortez, that any detention without probable cause is improper. This isn't, the state had made the argument that this was a very short period of time compared to Little Brady.
You mean reasonable suspicion?
Oh, I'm sorry, reasonable suspicion.
Right, okay.
Thank you. The state had made the argument that this was a very short stop or very short inquiry compared to Little Brave. I don't think that's the issue. The issue is, did he have any right to approach him at all? And the cases have held that even momentarily stopping somebody in investigative detention, which this clearly was, and I don't think that's in dispute, is improper, even for a moment. So the question of whether or not this lasted a long enough time or a short enough time really isn't the question. When I'm talking about could this have been dispelled in a reasonable amount of time, approaching the passenger addresses all of the concerns that were set in Terry. It's reasonable to the scope. There's, you know, if the court would find on the first issue, there's reasonable suspicion to do so. The officer would have dispelled it within a few moments. He could have ID'd Mr. Hutchinson so that he knew what he was dealing with. Mr. Hutchinson would have said, here's the bottle of beer, it's unsealed, and that would have been the end of the stop.
Your time has expired, Mr. Peets. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Jasper, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. As was stated earlier, my name is Kirsten Jasper. I'm an assistant attorney general with the South Dakota Attorney General's Office. I do just want to thank the court for the ability to appear on behalf of Craig Eichstead today, as he was unable to be here. To start with, there are a few factual points that the state would like to assert. First, being that the time of day of this particular incident occurred was 1:30 in the afternoon. I don't believe that was mentioned, and I think when you look at the totality of the circumstances, 1:30 in the afternoon might come into play on what an officer reasonably suspects is going on in a vehicle. The other factual matter.
I don't know if I follow your point. It's not the cocktail hour.
It's not the cocktail hour. That's part of the point, I guess, is part of my point. Yeah. It's not cocktail hour.
How would that make it more suspicious, though, I guess? Somebody might go shopping for later on.
And that's true. But then when you see the officer had testified or the detective testified what he saw after that, when you add everything together, 1:30 alone, probably not. That taken alone isn't something. But when you put all of the pieces together and you get the full puzzle of the picture, I think that can play as one of the pieces. Does that clarify what why I was stating that?
How important is it that the trial court erroneously identified this business establishment as a liquor store and instead it was a convenience store? That's 1:30 in the afternoon. Maybe he's going in to get Gatorade.
I don't have an answer for that, Your Honor. I apologize. I did notice that when I reviewed the record. I don't know.
Okay.
It may have had something to do with why the officer was there earlier for a beer theft. He may have just got confused. I don't know.
What wasn't he carrying? Do I recall correctly? He was carrying a case of beer as well as the...
Correct. There was a case of beer as well as the bottle of beer in the brown bag when he came out of the store. That's my understanding. Correct. The other thing that I wanted to point out...
Is it clear that the officer knew what was in the brown bag? He said he was positive, but I didn't ever see that he actually saw it. Was that an assumption, or did he see it?
What he said, and I'm just reviewing my notes, I'm sorry, but what he saw was the gentleman come out with the brown bag over the beer. He he pulled it out of the bag and showed it to the other passengers in the vehicle is what my understanding was, like showing it up in the air so he could see, and he said he was absolutely certain it was beer at that point in time, is my recollection of what the facts showed. And then the description of what happened was as he was bringing the beer back down was what Detective Mazur, when he described the twisting motion or made that description to the trial court. And what the trial court said when it made its findings at the end of the hearing, the first thing that the trial court said with regard to that was you pretty much had to see it sitting in front of, erroneously, the liquor store. This is what the gentleman saw, twisting action. It appeared that he was taking the cap off. So it appeared certain to Detective Mazur that it was beer. It did end up to be beer, but he was certain that it was at the time. The other factual point that I wanted to point out was after this all occurred and the car exited the gas station, they only went about a two-block period of time. It's not a lot of time for this officer while he's making phone calls to call in backup to observe what all is going on to the car. Mr. Pietz noted, you know, he didn't see any other violations of traffic law or anything like that in the period of time he was following it. Well, it was only two blocks before he turned off and parked voluntarily. The other issue that I will briefly raise, and I believe it was briefly brought up in our brief, is that I'm not even sure we have a stop in this particular case or a seizure. The facts in this case clearly establish that we have a plain clothes detective, an unmarked vehicle that was not using its lights, sirens, or any sort of other, motion of authority when it pulled in behind this car that voluntarily parked in a parking lot.
How could he ask for a license then if it wasn't a stop? Didn't it make it a seizure at that point?
The law does allow, and even Terry does state, that law enforcement officers, excuse me just a minute here.
Well, then it's at least has to be an investigatory stop.
It does, but at that point he also did think that, I don't think it has to be an investigatory stop necessarily. There was the case Iverson, State v. Iverson. Let me find my notes here quickly.
Are you saying police can go around asking anybody on the street for identification? Do they walk by them?
That's not necessarily what I'm saying. No, Your Honor. I apologize. But law enforcement, according to Iverson, which is a 2009 South Dakota 48 case, law enforcement can conduct routine investigations and questions in public areas without it constituting an infringement on the rights of the Fourth Amendment rights of the people in the vehicle. With the case in Iverson, it was a car that was parked in a parking lot. It was late at the night. The car was running. The lights were off. The officer was aware that there were thefts in the recent history or some sort of criminal activity in the recent history. So he, because of that knowledge, went, knocked on the driver's door and asked for his identification, at which point he found that the occupants in the vehicle were intoxicated. So my point is that this may not have been a stop given the facts in Iverson, because he didn't stop the vehicle. He wasn't showing any authority. He just went up. He was investigating what he thought was a violation of law. Does that step to the standard of a Fourth Amendment infringement? I guess the state would assert at this point it does not.
Is there a difference? Most of our cases, if I remember correctly, are either possession of drugs, which is illegal per se, or it's a traffic violation, which is committed in the presence of the officer, or I suppose you could have underage possession. Here you've got none of that. Possession of a quart of beer in a car is completely legal, as long as you don't crack the seal. Is that a difference?
Is that a difference not when the officer felt or reasonably suspected that the bottle had been opened? I think that's where the distinction would be with regard to that question.
But how about Sound Sleeper? He's the defendant here, not Huntington or whatever his name is.
Correct. But like in cases, and I believe it was Justice Center that was asking Mr. Pietz earlier, was in traffic violations, you go, you question the officer, but then you continue to question all the other passengers in the vehicle. It's what got you in that door why isn't the same true in this case for the defendant? Why can we in cases with traffic violations, when we're not presuming that any of the passengers were in violation of any law, if they were speeding or whatever the case may be, why do we get to ask them and further ask them about things and find violations of law on them, but not in the return, not in the opposite as in this case?
But is it unreasonable to expect that the officer, when his suspicion was there was an open container, to first go and determine whether or not a crime has been committed before he starts questioning everybody in the vehicle?
Justice Meyer,
and that's the argument, that he should have gone to, if he had reasonable suspicion, then you pursue that reasonable suspicion and you ask enough questions or observations to see if that is the case, and if not, you have to let him go.
But is it unreasonable? To an extent, it is Terry. However, in Terry, there were three, if I remember, three individuals that were involved in that particular case, two of them, Terry being one of them, were the two individuals that walked back and forth in front of this business and paused in front of it a total of 24 times, if I remember correctly. The third individual had only stopped once. The law enforcement officer had only seen him stop and talk to these two individuals one time. And the next time he saw them, those two individuals with that third individual, he went up and spoke to all three of them to get their identifications, which also at that point with Terry is when the frisk occurred, and that was the intrusion of the Fourth Amendment rights, which is clearly much further than Detective Mazur went in this particular case, where he was only asking for identification versus a pat-down of the body. However, Justice Meyer Henry, the standard is whether or not they had reasonable suspicion to do what they did. Law enforcement, it's enough for the stop if it's based on specific and articulable facts, which taken together with rational inferences from those facts reasonably warrant the intrusion. But the other part of it is what would a reasonable officer do? In this case, was it unreasonable for the officer to first go to the driver of a vehicle that had just stopped in a parking lot? For safety reasons, officers typically go to the drivers. Why?
He doesn't testify he was doing that for safety reasons.
I may be wrong at which one it was looking at, but I'm not sure that they did either, but something is in my head about that, and I don't recall why.
It's on page 12, and it's the officer said that he did it for purposes of identification.
Okay, is that what he said?
Yes.
I thought there was something in why he had stopped there. And I appreciate you pointing that out to me, Justice Center. But officers are frequently allowed, I guess this court has at least cited to the Maryland versus Wilson case, and I think that was in Vento, but I may be wrong on which case that was cited, or it was cited, I believe, in Hodges, actually, that the officer has the opportunity to take command of the situation, take command of the car. And one way, or probably the best way to do that, is to get command of the driver, which would be the defendant in this case. You have a better ability to figure out what's going on in the car if you go to the driver. You have better ability to make sure that the driver is not going to take off.
Mr. Pete says, though, that the car was locked in. The officer was parked behind him, and so the car couldn't have gone anywhere anyway.
I believe what Detective Mazur's testimony with regard to that was that he actually didn't know how much room there was between the cars, and he didn't know if he could or could not back out. So I believe the Iverson case pointed that fact out as well, that the record didn't show for sure that he was not able to back out. There was no indication that he didn't feel like he was free to leave the situation if he wanted to, and I think that's important to note as well. I believe there was a question on whether or not there are cases where a violation of a passenger was witnessed and they questioned the driver in that case. The Ramos case, which is cited in the briefs, was a case, I believe, out of Iowa, if I remember correctly, where the passenger was not wearing his seatbelt. And in Iowa, the law allows officers to pull over into vehicles for a seatbelt violation only. In that particular case, the law office, or the officer in that case, not only asked for identification, but pulled the driver back into his vehicle. And at that point, after much information was acquired, then they found the violation for possession of a large amount of marijuana. But that's a case that's somewhat similar to this case, where the violation in the vehicle had to do with the passenger, not the driver, even though it's out of Iowa. I believe it's an Eighth Circuit case. So
the problem with that case is the court said that even though there was no violation by the driver, we're going to assume for purposes of the appeal that it was lawful to question the driver. So the court really never addressed the question, as I read the case.
Okay. I guess I don't recall that, but that doesn't mean that I did a quick review, so I could very well be wrong on that. Like I said earlier, this isn't a standard of what, and I may not have said it this way earlier, what could have or should have been done, that he should have gone to the passenger side, but it's what is reasonable. And the reasonable aspect, was it unreasonable for the law enforcement officer to go to the driver's side to begin questioning at that point in time? And the state would assert it was not unreasonable. The driver has control over the vehicle. For a variety of potential safety reasons, a law enforcement officer is going to feel better if they do approach from the drivers to get control of the vehicle, to get control of the situation. And that does not make it unreasonable to do that type of a search. When you look at the totality of the circumstances, if you presume that there was a stop in this particular case, if you look at the totality of the circumstances, the fact that it was 1:30 in the afternoon, Detective Mazur, visually...
Me. What does 1:30 in the afternoon have to do with the violation?
I don't know necessarily that it does, but I'm just pointing
it
out.
That was the first thing you brought up. So.
Well, it was a fact that wasn't brought out earlier, the time of day. To me, and if you know me, it's probably not surprising, but 1:30 in the afternoon and you're picking up a case of beer and a bottle of beer on it isn't something that I think personally is normal. But I know it happens. It's not what I would do. But then you get into a car and you see what you think is a twisting action. Why is that not? Why wouldn't that maybe be part of the puzzle? I don't know.
I'll ask the same question that I asked Mr. Peets, and it ties into what you said. Is this racial profiling?
Particularly
since you were tying it to a time of day.
I guess I don't know how time of day and racial profiling go together either. Well, I did bring up time of day. I will admit that. I can't answer the racial profiling. I actually, when I read the briefs, I didn't. I think it was in the reply brief that Mr. Peets mentioned their race, and I had no clue up until that point in time. So I can't answer that. I wasn't the detective. I don't know. It certainly was not brought out in the record whatsoever. When you read the transcript, it wasn't mentioned as far as the suppression hearing goes. When you look at the totality of the circumstances as to why, if you believe there was a stop occurred, with the fact that there appeared to be, to Detective Mazur, a violation of law, the open container law, his approaching the driver's side of the vehicle and requesting identification was not unreasonable under those circumstances. He's required to investigate violations of law, and that was what he perceived to be a violation of law. And I think it was.
Let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Peets. Is there a case that supports you other than the Iowa case? Well, we're not talking about someone brandishing a weapon or something. That might be different circumstances, but here we're talking about him seeing a passenger with a bottle of beer, and he's not seeing him pass it around or even drinking from it. What case do you have that supports the idea that the police can, instead of going to the passenger and going to the driver?
A case specific with going to the passenger other than the Ramos case, I do not have. I would just say that the analogy, if you can reach the passenger through the driver, it should go the other way as well. That would be, and there's numerous cases with regard to that. So that would be my response to that, Justice Cohen-Camp. The other thing I would like to point out is that the asking for identification is not unreasonably intrusive either. He did not request that he come back to his vehicle and start his investigation in that regard. He did start his investigation at the door rather than requesting the driver to come back to the window. It was the initiation of his investigation at that point in time. Obviously, once... Thank you, Your Honor. Obviously, once he found out about the driver's license violation, the rest fell into play. But I would like to still point out that this was a short period of time. The officer did attempt, or was attempting to at least stop the vehicle because of the suspicions that he had. And I think under the total circumstances presented in this case, based on the testimony by Detective Mazur in the suppression hearing, that there's enough evidence to, especially when given due regard, well, or regard to the trial court's visualization and being able to see the demonstration of what actually occurred in the car. As Justice or Judge Trimble stated, you pretty much had to see it. When you put all of that together, there was more than enough reasonable suspicion to request at least the initial identification of the driver of the vehicle. And with that, I would urge this court to affirm the trial court's decision to deny the suppression. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Jasper. Mr. Peets, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Peets, I want to clear something up before we start. And I know you didn't want to bring it up, but the profiling issue, I didn't see that was ever raised below, nor did I see it asserted in your brief. So that's not an issue in this appeal, is it?
It wasn't raised. I think under Wren it's not proper to raise it. I obviously have some concerns.
But you didn't propose findings on it.
I did not. I would like to start where the state ended off, and I want to caution the court to be clear that the court's factual findings that the officer saw the bottle of alcohol and the state statement then that allows them to approach the driver, I think, is the primary issue. And I don't think those two issues should be squashed together. The first is whether or not there's reasonable suspicion to approach these occupants at all. The second issue is whether or not those go towards found sleeper. And that's that, as I have stated, is the more important issue. I want to touch briefly on the fact that of the state's claim that this wasn't a seizure. That wasn't initially addressed in their brief, which is why I didn't mention it. However, I think that this is clearly a seizure. The officer parks behind them. The officer has a gun, a firearm on his hip. He has his badge displayed on his belt. He thought that he had his identification. He identifies himself as a police officer, and his first question is to demand a license from the driver. The standard is not, what the intent of the officer is. The standard in the case of a seizure is whether or not the person in that situation feels free to leave. If you reread the transcripts in regards to what the officer said, he had parked behind them when I asked, were they able to back out? And he was like, well, I'm not sure if they would have been able to get out. There would have been some difficulty. That was the general gist, which basically, if someone parallel parks me in and leaves me 6 inches in the front and the back of my car, yeah, I'm going to be able to get out. It's going to take me an hour or two, but I can get out.
Was there a finding by the court about whether he could get out or not?
I don't recall whether or not the court specifically made that finding. I do remember the court making the finding that the officer parked behind the vehicle. Beyond that, I don't remember if there was any specific finding whether or not he would have been easily able to get out. I don't believe it was the officer's opinion that he would have been able to easily do it. As far as him exiting the car, the officer standing in the by the driver's side door. There's a passenger in the passenger seat. Sound sleeper's only exit without actually moving the car would have been to either crawl across the passenger or make the officer move to get out of the vehicle.
But that isn't the question. The question is when the officer, you would have the officer go over to the passenger and start his inquiry there. And the question is, could the driver have just said, well, I'm not being detained, so I'm leaving?
I think he could have. At that point, I don't think there's a seizure.
So then why shouldn't the officer be able to go to the driver first then and make sure the car isn't going to leave before he goes to the passenger?
I think the, well, I mean, first of all, the vehicle's, his vehicle's parked behind him, so it wouldn't be able to just leave. Secondly, the officer can obviously give commands through the passenger side to the driver if he says, you know, don't leave. I don't know of many circumstances where, you know, an officer would be standing by beside a car that most people would feel that it's reasonable to just drive off and take the person they're talking to with them. I don't know if I'd feel that was reasonable if somebody was just talking to a friend of mine on the street to my passenger and I just would get, just take off. I'm not sure I'd feel free to leave in that particular case.
Well, we just, I think we just handed down a case here, was it last week, where the officers tried to stop a man and has that gone out? Is that a case of this? It's not out, all right. Well, we're not talking about that.
Never mind.
Too many cases.
I'm not saying that it would be impossible, but obviously if that were the case, then that would occur, then the officer would obviously make a traffic stop and would control the situation in that way. The state argues the question here is what is reasonable for the officer to do. I don't think that that's the question. The question is what is Terry's exception, the Terry versus Ohio's exception, what do they allow? And they only allow, throughout, under Terry versus Ohio and its progeny of cases, they only allow them to make an investigatory detention of a person that they have reasonable suspicion has committed a crime. Sound sleeper hadn't. The officer admitted that himself. That is the primary issue. Their scope is outside of it because they're asking for identification from somebody that is unrelated to the crime for which they're stopping. This is not the quickest way to dispel it. And as far as the safety issue, which quite frankly was never testified to the officer that this was why he did it, but isn't the most safe place for the officer to be within close control of the person that he's suspected of committing the crime? Isn't that the best place for him to be? If this was, if he had pulled this vehicle over for the suspicion that the passenger was wanted for murder, he's not going to be over near the driver where he can't see because of the roof of the car, he can't see what that person is doing.
Do we really want to go that far, though? I mean, that might be a on the scene judgment the officer has to make about which side of the car he wants to walk up to. We're just talking here about an open container. It wouldn't be wiser for us just to decide this issue without trying to decide whether stopping someone for suspicion of murder is would require the officer to go one way or the other?
Well, I don't think that the Terry case requires us to make that decision at all. Terry case says you have to approach a person you have the probable cause that has committed or the reasonable suspicion has committed the crime. I don't think we have to look at whether or not this was a safety issue for the officer or not. I think it's irrelevant.
That's a citizen on the street. That's approaching someone on the street. This is an automobile. And the Supreme Court has recognized all kinds of extra prophylactic protections when it comes to automobiles. Which leads me to my question. I asked Ms. Jasper about the Ramos case. I want to ask you as well. You know, the court assumed without deciding that the questions could be asked in that case. But there is some instructive language in the case that, of course, that's where the passenger was observed not wearing a seatbelt. And they went to the driver, and the court said, typically a reasonable investigation may include asking the driver's license and registration. Now, why shouldn't we apply that?
Well, I was actually flipping to the Ramos case when the state brought it up for the exact quote that you brought out of that case, that the court is assuming that the questioning of the driver was basically all right in this case. They didn't address that issue.
It means something. They assumed it was okay.
They're assuming that it's okay. I'm assuming that they're assuming that it's okay. What I'm guessing happened in the Ramos case was that wasn't the issue that was that was appealed. And the court stopped on that section saying, this might be a problem, but now it's not an issue for the appeal, so we're going to assume it's okay and move on because it wasn't an issue that was raised by the defense counsel in that particular case. I can only assume that that was the case. But I know that, I believe that was actually a Texas case, not an Iowa case. I don't know what Texas's law is on seatbelt, but I know that there's an element in our statute that says that if the car's in forward, the car has to be in forward motion, I believe, is part of the seatbelt requirement. So if the car's stationary, you don't have to be wearing a seatbelt. I think that forward motion might in some way implicate the driver. Getting to the more core of the question is whether or not that there's a difference. We've, you know, carved out exceptions, and I know that the court's referring to, like, the search exception with an automobile in regards to the automobile could leave, the evidence could be destroyed. The court in Terry versus Ohio said that the estimal, sorry, my lips are getting dry again. The inestimable right of a personal security belongs as much to the citizen on the streets of our cities as to the homeowner closeted in his study to dispose of his secret affairs. They're clearly stating that the person that's out on the street has no different level of protection than the person that's sitting in his home, which has obviously always been the highest level of protection given by any court in this nation, is a person in his home. They're saying in this particular instance, in the reasonable suspicion standard, that they have the same protections that somebody does in their home. They've never carved out an exception saying that a driver is instantly implicated simply because somebody else in the vehicle may have committed a crime. Terry analysis is very easy. Each step of it is analyzed to say, what does the officer have reasonable suspicion to, and who can he approach because of that? That may disappear as it did in Hand. It may increase as it has in other cases. But until he has reasonable suspicion to talk to Sound Sleeper, until he suspects him of a crime, he really has no business talking to him at all. Thank you for your time today. If the court has no further questions, I'll conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Peets. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.